I think the problem that the new AI faces is that just like the old AI, it's still completely missing the semantics. One thing I have to say is it's fun. I got to tell you, it's so much fun. Like, do you remember when you were first a graduate student?
Yeah.
And you just walked into this huge, incredible maze of fascinating facts, right? Well, once you become a PI, you sort of get sort of, you do your field, you read some paper, but you know exactly what they're going to say, or, you know.
Yeah.
This was like being a graduate student again.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey, it's Paul. Welcome to the show. This is the second part of my conversation with neuroscientist Paul Cisek. We continue right where we left off from the last episode. So you need to listen to that episode to get the full context for this one. As a very coarse recap, though, Paul likes to approach understanding brains by going forward through evolution, that is, using a phylogenetic refinement approach to trace out the incremental steps evolution has taken to shape our brains and behavior. And he also likes to go backward through the brain, focusing on how we control ourselves and the environment by taking actions through feedback mechanisms. Today, we start by talking about how AI figures in all of this, framed by his recent debate with Blake Richards about whether we should use normative approaches to study brains. And we go on from there. Hyungjun, Mike, Dan, and Mikkel, my gratitude to you guys for your support on Patreon. I am putting the finishing touches on the first installment of the Brain Inspired course. I promise it's happening. Anyway, for you Patreon supporters, you'll soon get an email on how to access the course. And I'll announce on the podcast when it becomes available to everyone else as well. I have plans in the work also to start occasionally posting little episodes just for Patreon supporters. These Patreon-only episodes will likely be a little shorter and lean more toward the cultural side of science, with a little more time devoted to advice and lessons people have learned and so on, but also with plenty of science and big questions. So go to braininspired.co to learn how to support the show through Patreon. It's super cheap for you, and it helps me more than you know. Also, find today's show notes there with links to a lot of the excellent books that Paul recommends and his own work on the topics that we talk about. Be well out there and keep pushing onward, everyone, in science and in life. Enjoy the show. I actually had invited you on the show before I knew, and you informed me that you were going to be doing this big debate with Blake Richards at the Neuromatch Unconference,
yeah,
or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was framed as a debate. And in fact, I enjoyed the back and forth. I haven't seen a quote-unquote debate that has, I think it needs to be, they need to stop framing them as debates because no one treats it like that, and, you know, people want
to
see
blood. The thing is, I think, you know, a lot of people were all excited about seeing blood, but it's a little difficult to try to have a debate in public with someone you like, you know, and really go after the jugular. It's a little embarrassing, and I think... Neither of us really wanted to be too brutal.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're really so much in opposition. It's more of a, I feel it's fine for people to take that approach. It's not what I'm going to do,
yeah,
because I don't think it's promising, but I wouldn't want to discourage multiple approaches. Now, Blake and I, we don't know each other for that long, but our kids are friends in school. In fact, I was just told that they were playing together. Well, not within 2 meters, but
of course
they were playing together. They saw each other at the park just now. So,
Yeah. No. So no one got like a bloody lip or anything after
Nobody
got
a bloody lip. Yeah. It was kind of disconcerting to see that as we were talking, there was this chat box going through with people going, we want to see blood. We want to see them. Both participants dead by the end. It's like, wow, this is
I know people love their Game of Thrones or whatever. I don't know what the new things are. But even like the chat, like why would you? I don't know. I have opinions about having a chat on during a talk. Because it just means you're not paying any attention.
It was distracting.
Yeah, if you're chatting. Anyway, so I enjoyed the back and forth. And these debates, it's a false dichotomy. They pit a false dichotomy often where the people debate, quote unquote, debating or trying to go pro versus, pro and con on an idea. They really end up overlapping in their thought processes a lot. I don't know. So there's got to be a better way to frame it than debate.
Well, the thing with the... the AI approach is, I am actually quite against it. I mean, certainly I myself don't think it's promising. I don't think normative explanations are really the way to go because we have no idea what that objective function should be. And I think it's probably impossible to come up with it in a way that will lead us better than good old hypothesis-driven experimentation.
Let's just back up and say what the normative approach is. So you mentioned objective function.
Well, the idea that we try to understand the brain in terms of how it optimizes a particular problem that's formally defined with some kind of metric that tells you how well you're doing. And that metric presumably defines a kind of a space of systems where you can say this one is better than this one. And you don't, as Blake pointed out, you don't expect to find the global optimum. You just expect to find a way of trying to understand the system in terms of how it is, especially in particular learning in the system, of how it's actually trying to at least improve its performance according to that metric. My critique of it is that I just don't, it's a little bit like the problem of definitions. Now, instead of having defined a thing that we will now explain, now we start with an objective functions that we will then try to optimize or relate to neural activity or changes in learning or something. And I think that if you start with it, your chances of getting it right are not so good. So I think that. Again, I wouldn't say that people shouldn't do it. And of course, people will use that approach. Deep learning is very exciting. But I think, unfortunately, like cognitive psychology, cognitive revolution, much of it is asking questions that I don't think, I myself, in my opinion, don't think are good questions. And it's, again, because they start, with things like, how do you encode knowledge, right? And I think that's not where, again, if... an evolutionary viewpoint will suggest those are not problems that were really, they're not the fundamental problems that subdivide and lay the foundation of the brain.
One thing that you must appreciate some and that has been celebrated in large, I think, by the neuroscience community, that AI does well is they define the task to be performed. Let's say it's object recognition or something. Yeah. But then, they don't constrain their network. The network performs the task.
Yeah.
And then you can look back and see how, so there are some constraints in how you set it up and the objective function and the architecture. Then you can look back and it turns out that the, a deep learning network that was constrained, by early simple and complex cells from a Hubel and Weisel and through the neocognitron, but without a lot of other constraints that were being added into networks, if you train it on a task, it actually the neural representations
look
better
like
match.
Control. That's fantastic. Yeah,
it is. It's fantastic. But so you must appreciate that aspect of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I think especially in those cases the function was probably sensibly defined. The idea that you want to categorize images in particular ways is, I maybe critique the foundations of putting everything in terms of knowledge building and representation, but of course you have to categorize, if only because some things are things you want to approach, some things you want to avoid, some things you don't care about, right? And so categorization is a pretty good theologically relevant problem that the brain is probably solving. And networks, you know, highly redundant and distributed systems will come up with a mechanism for doing that categorization, which doesn't necessarily have to have human interpretable elements. So I think that's a good example. The bigger problem, I think, is that just because that does work for some problems can't be assumed to be a framework for neuroscience as a whole. And in particular, I think the problem that the new AI faces is that just like the old AI, it's still completely missing the semantics. Like I was saying before, the old AI and sort of cognitive theories and old AI systems always had this problem of lacking semantics, again, symbol grounding problem.
Symbol grounding, yeah.
Yeah, Chinese room. And the reason is because the problem was defined from the outside. The problem was the system was designed to solve a problem defined by an external agent, and it solved essentially the syntactic aspect of the problem, right? And that's what current neural networks are doing. You know, whether it's supervised or unsupervised learning, the problem and the metric and the objective functions defined externally to the algorithm. It's the designer or the researcher or the programmer that defines what the problem is, and then the thing has to solve it, right? So just like good old-fashioned AI, it doesn't have the internal semantics. It doesn't know what the meaning of the symbols is, or the vectors, or you know, intermediate tuning functions, or whatever you want to call them. So, and it's, again, it's because the problem was you've sort of taken a chunk of behavior, defined it to be a explicit chunk that, let's say, represents objects in the world, and then you've placed it on its own, right? Now, what I'm saying is that suppose you think about it in terms of a control system, right? So suppose that you have an animal and it needs to run around the world and find food, avoid threats, not bump into things, etc.
Should we say robot instead of animal?
Yeah, let's say robot, right? So now, well, it needs to have categories. But what are the categories that it really needs? Now, it doesn't need categories for objects so much as categories for policies for interacting with the objects. You know, these are the things you avoid, these are the things you approach, right? Those are more fundamental categories, right? And, you know, it's like, all right, so you need to have a system that perceives the affordances in your world, and a system that prioritizes based on your current needs, which are the ones that you're going to now take advantage of or not, right? And so the categories are sort of action flavored again. Mm-hmm. If you define it that way, there's never really a meaning problem, because the system does have goals that there is kind of needs that are being met.
There's something at stake, yeah.
Something at stake, right? And whatever you discover about your world, you discover it because it actually does have meaning to your interaction that then helps your state. For example, and it's interesting that when you look at the ventral stream, right, I always thought of the ventral stream as ending in the infratemporal cortex, where you have these sort of high-level representations. But then there's a couple of papers that I read that made me rethink that. Wait a minute. One was a paper by Ben Hayden and a student, I forget his first name. And they wrote a paper that's saying, you know, that's what the orbital frontal cortex is really doing, using the same approach as has been used to explain the ventral stream in terms of a kind of a categorization system. But it's categorizing sort of value-based things. It's like things that are good to approach or things that are less good to approach, etc. And it's actually using the same algorithm, this entangling algorithm that people have used to interpret ventral stream processing. And I thought that makes really good sense. But the other thing that caught my eye is that at around the same time, I read a paper from Barbara Finlay and Uchiyama, who describe evolution of the neocortex as essentially the elaboration of two separate sheets, one which is spatial and one which is non-spatial. Mm. And it so turns out that the temporal cortex and the orbitofrontal cortex are part of that non-spatial system. It's essentially a continuous thing. It just so happens that in primates, the temporal ring really bulged out so much that it bent forward and created this lobe. And you, but if anatomically speaking, it's these two streams. And of course, that fits very well with my thinking about affordance competition, et cetera, because it's all about action selection, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, in that context, it makes good sense to have these category, these sort of clustering algorithm like things that process the images in a way that categorizes them into action specific things. But you know, you can think about the evolution of this thing in terms of key stimuli. So all these logical concepts of certain combinations of cues in the world that tell you this is good, this is bad. And it doesn't have to be an object as so much as things that are pointy are bad, or things that are, you know, big and moving fast, big and expanding, bad, right? So those kinds of categories are quite fundamental. So in that context, it makes good sense to have some of these types of representations, right? But if you start with that and build and try to build, so within the control context, and the idea that you need categorization for action selection because you can't do multiple things at once, it makes perfect sense to have these kinds of feature extraction type mechanisms. And I think one could come up with a relatively solid sort of evolutionary story of how that might have been elaborated over time. And you know, then you look at certain species and see what are their equivalent visual systems, right? But the thing is, but again, it's within that context. Once it's within that context, no problem, right? But if it's just about building knowledge, then it's going to be hard to, you know, it's not about, you know, why are you recognizing a pattern this way? Why are you categorizing the world this way? If you don't answer that question, then I don't think, then I think you're going to get the same trap that good old-fashioned AI did, that the semantics is never in there.
Well, it's because we desperately need to caption images, don't you know?
Well, yeah. But the thing is, it's great for that, though, yeah, right?
Right.
So for the engineering aspect, it's great, and that's why there's a lot of, you know, resources poured into it. But we shouldn't necessarily, just because it's so good for a problem that we've defined, we shouldn't necessarily assume that that's the right way to break up the brain. That this is where we begin the problem. Now, let me say one other thing about that is that reinforcement learning work is actually doing very much like what I would say is the right.
This is my next question. So yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like, yeah, a lot of the things I say, reinforcement learning, a lot of that work is about kind of solving the control problem, right? And the objective function there is survive, right? Which that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
And then the question is find ways of dealing with your world in such a way to make sure you don't not survive, right? And so I think the reinforcement learning work is actually quite promising because it does address the problems of semantics. And the way I see it is that the semantics has to come from within, right? The semantics of the representation can only exist once that representation is part of a control system. Then it's trivial, right? It has meaning because it does something for you. If you don't have it inside a control system, then it's hard. Then it can't have meaning, right? So I think the reinforcement learning work does actually do that. And I think the reinforcement learning work is helping us. And it is actually sort of leading towards strong AI, where you could actually have real AI, because it doesn't let go of the semantics along the way. It keeps the semantics in the system and then just elaborates the system, but always with the semantics.
Would it be fair to say that a non-reinforcement learning system, its meaning is only, it's not within itself, but it's only within us because we're the users and we're the...
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, like, you know, a word processor is very useful for us, but it's not an AI system, right? It's just like a image labeling system, right? It has no use for itself. You know, even AlphaGo didn't really have the use of maybe winning. Although I guess AlphaGo was essentially trained still with a reinforcement learning approach.
Right. It was, yeah.
So in a sense, whatever representations it had did have meaning in the context of the goal. There was still a state that was being controlled.
So there can be meaning without subjective awareness of that meaning, I suppose. And we don't need to go down that road, but.
Yeah, let's not go down that
road.
But I think the problem is that if you take a chunk of behavior outside of the control loop You risk not having the semantics that come from the control aspect. And I'm not sure you could do it without that. Maybe you can, but I don't think people are doing that. So that's why I think a lot of the AI excitement is likely to lead to another big bursting bubble when we have better image classification algorithms and maybe more robust robots. But you know, I want a robot butler.
Right.
I want to be able to have a conversation.
Yeah, I didn't appreciate that AI winter referred more to the economic aspect of everything than the actual progress being made, which and I don't know that there's going to be another AI winter in that sense, because there are very useful technological industrial applications.
I don't think people are not going to be able to get jobs. I do think there's going to be a bit of a backlash to the hype. But, you know, it's interesting because I looked into once, before giving a talk on some of this stuff, I looked into where the hype is coming from. The hype is not coming from the people doing the AI.
Yeah, right.
They know better. They know better than to promise, you know, some of those promises that were made in the 60s. You know, nobody's doing that. It's more the media and the industry that's hyping it up.
Yeah. Just to stick with reinforcement learning for one more notion here. So just going back to the first, you know, enclosed membrane, self-sustaining organism, you know, could you consider reinforcement learning the original objective function in that sense?
Well, no, I think survival would be the original objective function, and just metabolic state, et cetera. You mean like an objective function for learning?
Well, no, like, so I'm sorry. So objective function for going up the food gradient, up the solution gradient to find more food, because it's depleted its resources, it's consumed all of the nutrients in its region and has to move, right? So then there's one that developed some sort of motor ability through random chance, through evolution, and thus can randomly move into a new environment. And could we consider that an objective function?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it would help us to call it an objective function. I mean, I think if what you've described already, you know, so I think there's an interesting link here with dopamine. You know, this idea that dopamine state tells you to stay put versus go somewhere else across all kinds of animals, you know, including jellyfish, et cetera, right? The idea that if that was one fundamental role of dopamine, then within the system that keeps you local, it would be helpful to have, on top of the general tonic level of things are pretty good, so stay local, it might be useful to have, hey, just now was really extra good, right? And if the animal detects that and reinforces somehow what it just did in the present context, it's reinforcement learning, right? It's now not just intake rate, it's specifically little punctate bits of things were extra good now, or not as good as the background rate, right? And then that brings in the phasic dopamine aspect, which has been associated with this kind of reward, sort of difference in expected versus actual rewards. And so maybe that's a connection as to why within that system that deals with local behavior, there's this kind of associative learning through reinforcement, you know, where you reinforce certain actions in a certain context, because they do have a little extra burst, a little punctate burst of goodness, you know, from signaled by dopamine. I mean, you know, it's possible. It makes some predictions as to where things should, you know, how dopamine receptors maybe should be distributed in the brain.
Yeah.
And there's algorithms, reinforcement learning algorithms, and you know, it did, you know, reinforcement learning. I guess I don't know exactly where it's been proven to occur, but certainly by the earliest vertebrates, we have it, and the circuits have been retained for essentially until now.
The dopaminergic reinforcement learning.
Dopaminergic system, the basal ganglia, the ventral tegmental area. These things are these structures exist in lamprey. Homologous structures exist with the properties that one would expect. The circuit has been fairly well established, and you know, so that's, unless they happen to evolve the same circuit as we did, it was there for half a billion years, you know, and it's a very fundamental thing. And also there's good reason to believe that that was one of the reasons that our ancestors did make it through those turbulent times, because they were able to do these, to learn a little bit about their environment.
There's a lot of elaboration. Yeah. But so you don't see the need to posit, 37 objective functions that define a general theory of brain.
I just don't know what those objective functions would be.
Yeah.
Like, let me give you an example. I mean, you know, people talk about evolution as a optimization process, but it's a weird optimization process because it keeps changing what the objective function is, right?
Yeah.
And if you were to create an objective function that, let's say you were to do a genetic algorithm and you wanted to happen to create the same kind of path that we actually took in our history, you'd have to keep changing its objective function in all kinds of ways that contradict each other. So, you know, the objective function 300 million years ago is not the same as the one 100 million years ago, right? And they actually point in different directions. And I think you'd have to go through you'd have to add so many terms in that function to drive the system to something that produces what looks like our brain, that I would say, why not just look at what the history actually is? And what would you get more out of having to guided your system to do this rather than just follow what actually did happen, which we do have data on?
I think I remember Blake saying the question was, do we need to look to evolution? And I think his position was, no, we don't need to. And I guess that's a truism almost. But
for AI, we don't need to, I think.
Well, but his interest is the brain as well.
Yeah. I think for the brain, we kind of do. I think we do. I don't think ultimately, and I think it comes down to that thing that we started at the very beginning talking about, right? Definitions, right? I think it's extremely hard to come up with the right definitions, right? And that's true for any science, right?
Yep.
And I kind of see as evolution gives us a crutch that lots of other scientific fields don't have. Right, is that we have a pretty good idea about what type of process produced the thing we're interested in, the brain, right? And we have data that we can use to infer the stages in which things appeared, right? And if we have that data, why not use it? Why not let it guide us to define things? So getting back to phylogenetic refinement, I think the idea is that you don't define problems or systems until you get to the state where they become relevant. So something like mobile animals, certain things become relevant when you have mobile animals. Certain things become relevant when those animals encounter predators or get out on land and suddenly vision is expanded dramatically.
Yeah.
Or they take the nocturnal route because the diurnal route is being dominated by gigantic thunderous lizards, right? there's certain things that happened that led the brain to develop in certain ways, and we can reconstruct that, and that now gives us a guidance of what are the definitions that we should of the problems that we should be asking. And I just kind of feel like if we all agree that the brain evolved, then why not use that?
Because it's hard, Paul. It's hard. There's not like a table of all the behaviors throughout all the evolutionary steps. It takes someone to actually do the work and spend 20 years writing a book.
Well, no, but people are doing it, right? And I'm not saying me.
Yeah,
I'm saying there's a whole field of people doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe we should give them more funding. Maybe we should funnel some of that big AI money to the people doing comparative embryology or something.
Right. The lamprey.
The lamprey people. The shark. We need more shark researchers.
More sharks. Yeah.
Well, small sharks maybe, but no. I mean, I think there is actually a lot of knowledge there. And it's there's debates. Okay, so there's a few outstanding major debates in the field that are very vibrant and who knows which way things will go. And it's kind of important to know. But I actually think, I actually would call for more investment in that type of research if you're really interested in about the human brain, because it makes some of those mysteries dissolve, just like, life dissolved, the mystery of life. So I think it is actually there. Like, I spent a lot of time reading this stuff and I haven't even really I mean, I've scratched the surface.
Yeah.
But there's always more, and it's actually a very daunting challenge to choose what to read.
Right.
But I have people help me. I mean, Steve Wise, for example, has helped me tremendously, suggesting to me where to go. And I contact some of the people whose stuff I read to find out where to go next, et cetera. I mean, the knowledge is there. And a lot of it again is just exploding now with techniques.
Yeah.
Genetic techniques, for example, are establishing the phylogenetic tree very solidly now. The timing can be estimated at least. The fossil evidence is always difficult, but there's so much more than that. And development in particular, because development is so constrained, because evolution can only make such small changes, the developmental biologists actually can tell us a lot of things about what happened.
That constraint is key.
Yeah. And so I actually think, it's a lot of work, but, you know, lots of people are already doing the actual hard work, right? And I just think that for us, we just need to read more of it. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I'm doing it, but anyone can do it. One thing I have to say is it's fun. I got to tell you, it's so much fun. Like, do you remember when you were first a graduate student?
Yeah.
And you just walked into this huge, incredible maze of fascinating facts, right? Well, once you become a PI, you sort of get sort of, you do your field, you read some paper, but you know exactly what they're going to say, or, you know.
Yeah.
This was like being a graduate student again.
So there's a naivete. That's a joyous naivete. That's important.
It's joyous. And it's just so much more of it. Now, it's also incredibly confusing, right? Because you don't even know what the words mean, right?
Right.
They use all kinds of jargon. You don't know it. But, I mean, that's how it was in graduate school,
again,
too.
Again, yes, yes.
You know? Yeah. So, again, it's actually, for me, it was a lot of fun. You know, as I tell people, it's the most fun I have is when I read some of this stuff, because I'm once again a student with this whole world being opened up to me.
But you can't do this. You can only do this so many times in your career, right? Where you just take on an entire new field because it's so massive. I mean, how many more do you have in you?
I'm not doing the research. I'm just reading.
But you have to spend, but you are immersed because you have to be. And yes, it's joyous, but it is a huge chunk of your mental resources, right?
Yeah, well, again, but actually tell you the truth, you know, other than time constraints, I don't feel it takes me away. In fact, I think it's shed light on some of the rest of my work. Some of the rest of my work, I think, makes more sense to me now. I know slightly better maybe how to do monkey cortical neurophysiology. Yeah, so it's really pays off. And I think I would highly recommend anybody doing it. And I thought doing it during a sabbatical was a good idea. Now I have an actual project. I actually want to write this book, which is, it's going to be kind of a very, you know, speculative book. And in order to do that, I have to learn all this stuff, right? You know, it'd be maybe harder for myself to motivate if I didn't have a long-term project. It'd be hard to just say, oh, instead of publishing the next paper, I'm going to go read something about some creature I didn't hear about until last week. that would be harder to motivate, but I don't know. I actually think it's extremely worthwhile. I mean, I would say my thinking has grown a lot by reading all this work. I'm just hoping I pick the right authors to follow.
Yeah, I'm hoping that you steer me. You point me to the right authors once you do all the work of finding them. So.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I'd be very sorry. I mean, I can tell you, if Puelas is wrong, then I'm going to be in big trouble. Yeah, I'm also buying into Grillner, but, you know, you look at the quality of their work and you can sort of feel like you can trust it. They're serious and they're careful and their methods are sound. They're not off the deep end. They're not just some kook somewhere spouting some nonsense, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a worthwhile investment. And like I said, it's a lot of fun.
Speaking of graduate school, you got into neuroscience through computer science, from what I understand. You started in computer science, and you were a graduate student with Steve Grossberg, in Steve Grossberg's lab. His name's been coming up more and more frequently lately, it seems like, but I really wasn't that familiar with him. Naive days of grad school. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm much less naive
now. Jeff Schall must have.
Not really. I mean, there's just a... Maybe I just missed it because it's not the one that keeps recurring and recurring. But I came through sort of Mark Summers' lab. So I was Bob Wertz and Mickey Goldberg and that, you know, and Shaw. But do you think that Steve Grossberg is, do you think he's not as well known as he should be?
Well, you know, in some fields, he's actually extremely well known. But I don't think in neuroscience he's as known as I think he should be. And I what I mean by that is that there's certain things that he said that people are only getting around to now.
Yeah.
In particular about dynamical systems and circuit level stuff. It's not about representations, it's about dynamics, you know?
Yep.
He's been saying that since the 60s. So, and I think a lot of neuroscience has sort of rediscovered some things he said a long time ago. And, you know, it's always difficult. You know, I mean, he was writing in the Journal of Applied Math. I mean, you know, who in neuroscience is really going to come across those papers, right? So I don't think in neuroscience and in computational neuroscience, he's appreciated as much as he should be. Because people are, you know, reinventing a lot of the things he said. And I think he had a really good attitude about, you know, modeling. So my other supervisor there was Dan Bullock, and he's got a great quote. You know how people do a model and it has many parameters and it explains a lot of data? People say, well, you know, you've got a lot of parameters. You can explain a lot of data with this. Mm-hmm. Dan Bullock has a great response to it. Oh, yeah? Try it.
Yeah.
Because what they try to explain is everything from neuroanatomy to psychology to neurophysiology. And yes, the models have a lot of parameters, but the data set is not just large, but broad and across level. It's really, really hard to actually do it with all those constraints, right? And I would add to that still the evolutionary constraint, right? Which actually I got onto that from them. They did models, for example, of the spinal cord in which they reconstructed them following some of the stages in evolution of certain cell types appearing, et cetera. And I think that's yet another constraint. And if you go through all that and you focus on the dynamics and behavior and physiology, et cetera, then you're going to come up with pretty good models. So I think that attitude is, I think, something that I got from them. And Grossberg, and I think a lot of people would, you know, a lot of people would, I think, benefit if they knew more of Grossberg's work. Which is not to say that I agree with everything that he's written, because he's written so much.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to try to get him on the show, but it's like, what? I got to read all of his.
You should. Yeah, you should. He'll be very. I think he'll be very happy to do it. Anyway, I'm glad actually that his name is coming out more, because it seemed to me when I was there. A lot of what I learned was through their lens. But, you know, once I got out, it seemed like people just, how can people not know that he addressed this problem?
Right. Yeah. That must happen so frequently, really.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, you know, sometimes he addressed it and maybe they disagree, but often people are just not aware of it. And I think it's because, you know, I there's so many things you can read.
Well, but he has always been a very well-read researcher. Oh, yeah. And you are too. I heard Jeff Hinton was asked, I don't remember the question, but he said that he likes a piece of advice that one of his advisors had given him one time, which was, don't read the literature, because if you read, you won't go on and figure it out yourself. You should go figure it out yourself. Don't read the literature. So what's the right amount of reading?
So I would say something different. I would say, read the stuff that people in your field aren't reading. I would say, because the stuff that everybody's reading, you're going to hear about that anyway, right? I mean, if you're in the field of, you know, cortical primate decision making or something, you're going to read those papers. You're going to come across them, right? So read the other stuff. Read the stuff that people in your field aren't reading, because then you'll have something new to offer, some new idea, new perspective from a different field. And you know, so, you know, in a sense, I would agree with Hinton's attitudes, like, you know, don't just follow in with your field.
Mm.
Don't just follow along with what everybody else is doing and just say, all right, well, this is the current thing that everybody's talking about. You know, if this thing gets 17,000 Twitter retweets, then that's what I should read. Well, you're going to hear about that anyway.
Yeah.
You're not going to add something to that conversation, probably. Go read something else. And then maybe you'll discover a connection that neither field knows about, right?
But will anyone listen to you is the problem. I think that you're taking a gamble when you venture off, because you do need to feed yourself.
Well, that is a problem. Yeah, well, that is a problem. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, as long as I can survive and get my grants renewed, I want to do what I want to do, right?
Yeah.
And it's true. It would bother me if nobody cares. Obviously, it would bother me if nobody cares. But certainly, following along with what everybody else is saying, again, I don't see myself making contribution to that. I would just repeat, you know, I would just repeat the same thing everybody else said.
It's not fun either.
Well, yeah, and I don't think I would do any better than what they're saying.
If I was, right.
I mean, there's a lot of incredibly brilliant people out there. So I think the easiest way actually to have an impact is to make a connection that between two large groups of people that haven't talked to each other. You know, it's actually amazing that some of these connections aren't there.
Yeah, there's still a lot. There's a lot of fruit to be had.
Yeah. You know, look, the stuff that I read about brain development, like, God, how is it that I wasn't taught that when I was in grad school? It didn't exist. A lot of it didn't exist.
Yeah, right. You know? But yeah. Why is it hard to find a good question? When you're in grad school, I got lucky because I was so naive and I had such a great advisor to let me do my own project. That doesn't seem to usually happen. But that was born out of my naivete, his misplaced trust in my ability to like take it somewhere. And I don't know that it was, you know, not necessarily a good question, but it was a lot of fun. But you know, connecting these disparate, otherwise disparate areas that where the real benefit that you can give to, you can contribute, you have to be able to ask the right question. And that's hard. And I think you've done that very well with your phylogenetic refinement approach. And it's because people see this thing and they're like, oh, yeah. Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Do they? No. Do they? I mean, I've had very positive comments from people who have contacted me about it, but it just seems like a lot of people, it's just not on their radar.
Well, I was going to ask you the same thing, but I think this approach is becoming... It's getting louder and louder, coming from different quarters. You've been at it for a long time.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Anyway, getting back to asking a good question, I think that's very hard because you usually will inherit questions from your advisors, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did to a large extent inherit questions, and it was mostly like, for example, that they exposed me to Gibson, right? Reading Gibson was a big deal that changed the way I approached. When I came in from a computer science background, I had a certain attitude. And reading Gibson changed that. And you have to be sort of plastic when you start out, right? I think you have to be lucky to be steered in the right direction.
What about humble?
Humble. I think you have to be willing to give up on things, beliefs you held dear. That's harder to do later on, though, right? That's harder to do later on. I've done it a couple of times. I mean, Graziano turned me from some... When I first heard of his ideas, for example, I didn't buy it. And I became convinced over time. Some other ideas that I've let go of because over time I've gotten exposed. But again, it comes down to reading other stuff. Again, it's just read other stuff. You'll get those ideas.
I think one problem, though, and maybe problem is the wrong word, because it can be great if it's done well, but you start off in grad school, you're exposed to the questions that your advisors were exposed to. You know, you make some advances, but then all of a sudden, you're like 2 years in, and it's almost like the rest of your career is set because, you know, in your case, let's see, you've been exposed to Gibson. This started you on this track, and yes, you got lucky, let's say, and, you crossed all the T's. You got lucky. You worked hard. You were smart, so you know you could make advances. You're humble,
so
you
had good supervisors.
You had a good supervisor, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, you could really like define the rest of your career based on you can kind of see it, right? And so it's hard to know, like, well, when should I?
Yeah, when should you settle into it, and when should you keep exploring? Yeah, well, that's a tough one. I think it's actually a good idea to every once in a while snap yourself out of whatever you've sort of settled into and try something different, just to get another perspective to see whether what the choices you've made are good ones. And I don't think I've really done that because I've pretty much followed. You know, I'm pretty much, you know, the idea of the brain as a control system was essentially my first year in graduate school.
Right.
From Richard Dawkins, actually. but other people that I've read, like Ashby and Powers and Gibson, right? And since then, I've just become one of these card-carrying, embodied and activism types, and just it's colored everything I do. And what if it's completely wrong, right? So that's a tough one, you know. But maybe when I say I read other stuff, still the stuff that I choose to read is still the stuff that satisfies those interests rather than other interests, right? I'm not reading linguistics because I don't think that's a good place to start, but it certainly would be different. So I don't know. I mean, I mean, frankly, I think, again, just reading what your field doesn't is already enough to help deal with that because you'll snap out of certain things that you otherwise wouldn't. And you have a better shot of learning something new that helps you in a new direction.
It takes very little external input to sort of jar the internal milieu that's already going on. So
yeah. Plus it's fun, and otherwise I'd just be keeping up with people who are much more productive and much smarter on doing all the same thing.
Right.
So that's not a good strategy either.
Speaking of being humble and naive, my last question, Paul, is what's an example of something that you used to believe that you now, looking back, consider naive?
I have an answer. It's almost embarrassing to say it.
That's the best.
Yeah. So before I went to grad school, I was at Microsoft, right? I already knew I wanted to go to grad school, but for a time I worked at Microsoft and I was offered the opportunity to stay. And this was the early 90s. So if I had stayed, you know, you calculate how much money I would have had. It's kind of disturbing, right?
Yeah.
The naive thing was I didn't want to delay going to grad school because I didn't want all the good questions to be answered.
Ah.
Right. As if they would be.
Because we would have it solved by now.
Because you'd have if I waited 10 years or something, sure, I'd have, you know, $12 million in the bank, but the whole brain would be figured out and what would be fun to do, right?
Yeah.
So now I think about it, that was pretty stupid because, you know, I could have used that money, you know? So that was pretty naive. That's certainly something I consider naive. But you were thinking about a scientific question.
No, I like that. I mean, you, the more naive things, the better. Yeah, you can't top that. Yeah.
That's about as naive as you can be. Yeah.
Paul, thank you so much for taking so much time. I've really enjoyed diving into your work, and I'm looking forward to having you back on the show in 2057 when you're done with your book.
Yeah, that's true. It should be. Yeah, I'll be rewriting chapter one at that point.
That's right. Right.
I'll be deciding, wait, I got this all wrong. Got to start from scratch.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway. Well, thank you again for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time. The stair